Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Emerge panel discussion, Connect Artists and Community, presented by the Washington Post. Before we start the conversation, I'd like to thank the Washington Post, our presenting sponsor, for their support. I would also like to thank Transformer. This panel is produced in collaboration with Transformer's Framework series. And of course, I'd like to thank our panelists, Margaret Boozer, Ryan Frank, James McAnally, and Abigail Satinsky. Last but certainly not least, I'd like to thank our moderator, Silvana Strahl. Silvana is an artist of many talents. As a poet and performer, she has received commissions from the Washington Performing Arts Society and Dance Place. She has performed throughout the country at prestigious venues, including the Art Institute of Chicago. Silvana has founded and produced performing arts events in numerous venues, including the Kennedy Center. She is also a philanthropic leader who is committed to serving the residents and nonprofit sector of the National Capital Region through vital programs such as the Creative Communities Initiative. It is a great pleasure to present Silvana Strahl.
Thank you, Jamie, and thank you, Victoria, for inviting me. So we have a really impressive panel of national leaders, of innovators who are developing new ways that artists can support themselves, each other, and engage community. So again, join me in welcoming Abigail Satinsky of Three Walls in Chicago, James McAnally with U.S. English and the Luminary in St. Louis, Ryan Frank with the Granary. In Connecticut, and the Wasaic Project in New York, and Margaret Boozer of Red Dirt Studios in Mount Rainier, Maryland. So I'm going to state the obvious, but it's a good place to start. The fact that we do not have a strong support system or infrastructure for artists and art making is not really news to anyone in the room, is it? Okay. And or that artists take on many roles in order to make it, in order to pay the rent, in order to create art, to create a better system and environment for ourselves, for other artists, and ultimately for the community, and why not the world? So as artists, we've been making it up ourselves from day one. Despite the challenges, it's our life calling. And we find a way to make art happen, no matter what. And the old model of artist support, such as competing for grants or the traditional gallery system, are just not cutting it. So most artists have to take on multiple roles and have multiple hyphens in their titles to match their multiple identities. My title is artist slash cultural organizer slash philanthropic advisor slash ape. And most of us know, you know, DIY, we were born that way. I came up in DC in the 80s, alternative scene, and we figured it out. Whatever money we made at the door, we used to pay other artists, and we put back into the making of art. And we're all very skilled at making things happen with very little. So the good news is that artists are getting even more innovative. Thanks to technology, we're more connected, we're more visible, less isolated, we're connecting like it emerged locally, nationally, internationally. And artists are also exploring systems that are working in other fields to inform our own system. However, we're still learning how to monetize our work, how to get paid what we deserve, how to build capacity and sustain our own organizations, to share resources, and how to deal with interesting and new challenges. So today's panel is going to share how they're creating new models. And just one other thing I want to touch on. I was very fortunate to be part of a 10-year national initiative called LINC and the Creative Communities Initiative, which was actually started by Holly Sidford and the Ford Foundation, and it went from 2002 to 2012. And the whole point was to create a stronger support system for artists in the U.S. by seeding efforts in 14 cities. And we looked at material supports, professional development, direct support, information networks. There's a lot of great resources online, the lessons learned, the original study at linknet.net. And so I'll end with, while we still have the challenge of an arts ecosystem that's out of whack, where artists, those who create and make the art, have fewer resources than major arts institutions. The good news is that people like the folks on the panel today are changing the system and have new models to share with you. So we're gonna start with James McAnally. And James is an artist slash curator and critic and a founder, co-director, and curator of The Luminary based in St. Louis. And he also serves as the executive editor and co-founder of the Temporary Art Review. In his artistic practice, he works as part of U.S. English, and he has work in Room 204 at Emerge, so stop by. So James, in addition to us wanting to hear about The Luminary and everything you're doing there, I also want to ask you specifically about your thoughts on how artists and artist-run spaces can sustain themselves in uncertain times.
Sure. Thanks. Wonderful introduction. I appreciate everyone for organizing this panel. I think all of those kind of different hyphen roles are kind of connected with the same mentality. They're all in a sense, taking it as a given that the support structures that currently exist are not only not full enough in their support, but are not always equitable, not always supporting risk-taking or the ways that we want to work. So as an artist, I'm part of a collaborative called U.S. English with my wife, Bree, and we're showing work here at Emerge with Transformer. It's called Strike Work, and that is taking a fundamental kind of position of what is our artistic labor and our labor more generally. How do we transform a system through that labor, through overwork and constant sacrifice? Because I think that's that idea of over labor and constantly giving to something is a part of that multi-hyphenated definition of the artist as curator, as critic, as teacher, as student, that we're all kind of making it work in these patchwork ways. So that connects with my work at The Luminary. We call ourselves an incubator for new ideas in the arts, which really kind of developed later out of an understanding as we were interested in taking those risks on behalf of artists, on behalf of other alternative and artist-run spaces, that we would give ourselves the opportunity to experiment with what was possible for an organization to be in the present moment. What did that look like? What did it look like to experiment more fully with that? And out of that work, we operate a gallery, a residency for like-minded artists and critics and curators as well. And artist equipment library to provide direct support to artists, but also it led us to start Temporary Art Review, which is something that we publish. It's an online publication that kind of addresses the couple of issues at the same time. One is that oftentimes for smaller spaces or pop-up events, it's really difficult to get press to have that work documented in a public way. And to have critical response to it, but also the range of that happening nationally in cities outside of kind of art centers or major art markets was really just not happening, and the models weren't working. So kind of the thing that I think connects all of those things for me is an openness to experimentation and kind of assuming that the models aren't working. You know, it's like I think we're beyond that conversation of is it working, is it not working, and as an artist and as someone who's, I guess, started several different projects, I always took that as a given, that whatever was going to happen was going to be from my own kind of creative potential, but also the network of people that I knew who were also mostly artists and didn't have those resources, but became a resource when taken together and when taken seriously as a kind of creative potential.
Thank you. So we're going to go next to Abigail Satinsky, who is the associate director at Three Walls in Chicago and co-founder of Incubate, a research collaborative dedicated to art economies. And also, she's a co-founder of Hand in Glove Conference, which is a national conference on grassroots arts organizing. She's also working on a book project on socially engaged art in Chicago. So, Abby, you have been involved with a number of different efforts to support, for direct support, as well as micro-granting, information networks such as the phone book, and other CSAs, like the Artist Subscription Series. And I'd like to hear about all of that, of course, but I also want you to talk about your show at Transformer.
Okay. So I guess I'll start just by talking a little bit about Incubate, because I think that's where a lot of my work comes from. So I used to run an artist space in Chicago called Incubate, and the point of that space was that we were trying to play with the form of a nonprofit organization. We were feeling like, as young people sort of looking towards being arts administrators and curators in our career, that we needed some space for experimentation. So we started this space and we did a whole range of projects, a lot of what places like the Luminary Center does. We did a residency and these sorts of things. But one of our major interests was thinking about this idea of the financial system that supports artists and how we could sort of play with that as well. And create a space that felt like it could serve artists' needs, which would be to, you know, functionally get some money for the projects that they're doing, but also try and figure out how to make an argument for a kind of expanded art practice. So in Chicago, as in a lot of other places, artists have a really expanded studio practice, and so that can take many forms that don't look like art. So say you're doing something like a community garden, and you wanted topsoil for your project or something like that, that kind of resource might be difficult to come by. And you know, the way the language has changed significantly in the last 10 years, so this is sort of more accepted than it was in the past. But regardless, we decided that we wanted to start a micro grant for that kind of work specifically, so that we could have a conversation about the value of that work and why artists needed the money for it. So we started a once-a-month grant at our space, which was called Sunday Soup, and we invited people over to make a meal, and then we took grant proposals up until the day of the meal, and it was very simple, so it was just a paragraph. And then everybody that came to the meal paid $5, and when they paid $5, they got a meal and an artist talk from a local organizer in the community, and then they got one vote and who got the grant. And so through that, we would raise about, we had a very small space, so we could only serve about 30 to 45 people at a time. So artists were getting about $350 per month. A different creative person was getting about $350. And we really felt like that was, it was both about the competition, about, you know, like that there was a really, there was something real at stake, but it also felt like a community forum to sort of decide, you know, as a group of people assembled in that space at that time, like why the arts are important, how we can sort of articulate that kind of argument for ourselves. And so with that, we started staging it in a bunch of different places. We did it in some exhibitions. We would sort of travel around and talk about it. And now it has sort of blossomed into this really large network of projects that do it all across the world. So there's about 65 of them. Margaret just told me that there's one right outside D.C. Where is it?
In Mount Rainier.
Yep. So, and what's been really great about this project is that, you know, we started in 2007, but people started all the time, and they don't need permission to start this project, and they don't need to credit us, and they don't need to have particular rules by it. I mean, really, it's a very simple thing that we adapted from other models that we know. I mean, it's not, we didn't come up with soup or raising money through getting together over a meal, but, you know, that there was sort of a certain kind of association with it. It's like, okay, we're going to vote and we're going to talk about creative projects. And so that that has that's really taken off in different contexts, and it's really exciting to see that people adapt it in a way that is very specific to a regional context, so that you know, communities need different things. It's not a one-size-fits-all sort of grant situation, and so these sort of autonomous situations are really exciting. And so that kind of leads into the show that I have at Transformer Gallery, which is called A Modest Occupation. And what that show is a collection of artist subscription projects. So this is sort of following along the same line. It's like artists that are starting these kind of micro businesses or kind of creative projects that raise a little bit of funds but also have all these other functions. So they raise awareness about different artist practices that you might not know about, and they create an affordable mechanism for which you can collect them. So for instance, at Three Walls, we do a project called Community Supported Art. Community Supported Art runs off a model like community-supported agriculture. So in the metaphor, Three Walls is like a farm, and then we commission a group of artists to make multiples, and we sell them at an affordable price because they're packaged together. And so you buy in at the beginning of a season, and then you receive the works. You don't know what the work is that you're going to get, so it's sort of like that vegetable kind of thing. So there's some fun built into it, and that also keeps the prices low. We're sort of playing with all of those things. Three Walls adapted that project through an organization in Minneapolis called Springboard for the Arts. And Springboard for the Arts operates differently. They're the ones that started it, but then there's all these other sorts of projects like it across the country. And we adapted it at Three Walls for something that made sense for us. So it's like, you know, we curate the artists based on a particular kind of criteria emerging to establish artists. Like, and so that's different than some of the other ones that act on proposal basis. And I think that something like Sunday Soup really led me to understand that these sort of models that exist out there in the world should be able to be adapted, and that we should feel, you know, the ability to offer them with respect to the people that originally came up with these ideas, that they're sort of floating around and that we don't need to ask permission necessarily, but sort of, you know, plug into the networks of people that are already thinking about this stuff. So that's what the show is at Transformer, which is about bringing together all those CSA projects and also kind of other artist-run sort of projects that are like this. So the Thing Quarterly, Alula Edition, the Present Group, these are artist-initiated projects, not coming from organizations, where they commission artists in their community to make multiples, and they sell them, and they create education around them, so interviews and things like that. Because it's also important to sort of look at the art that's coming out of that work, and so that's interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of really creative processes being generated through the idea that artists are making work in different forms, so, and for different audiences. So that was sort of the aim of bringing that work together.
Did you talk about Phone Book?
No, I didn't talk about Phone Book. So Three Walls does a number of publications as well, and one of the things that we do is we edit a book called Phone Book, which is a national directory of artist-run projects and spaces. And so that project is in its third edition, and it's grown significantly because we've seen the sort of growth of this kind of artist-run activity really. I mean, you know, it sort of ebbs and flows. It's not, you know, it's not to say that it's just much larger now than it has been in the past, but we see artists really creating a lot of resources for each other. So in the Phone Book, it's essays by the people that run these kinds of projects, and also just a directory. So there's about 750 listings in the book, and it's artist-run spaces, residency programs, event series, and community resources. And the way that we did the research for this is drawing upon the network of all these other kinds of projects. So I have relationships with all these different soup organizers in different cities. So we would sort of talk to them and be like, what's going on in your city? What's happening that's really exciting? What do you think should be in this book? So there's kind of a research practice that's also built on sort of trying to plug into these networks of organizers in different cities, because the Phone Book is about showing the things that you wouldn't know otherwise know about. Because a lot of artists run spaces, they run off their own internal networks, and you don't really know if you know unless you know. So this is sort of a way that, you know, there's like an access point for people.
So we'll move on to Margaret now. Margaret Boozer is an artist and taught for 10 years at the Corcoran College of Art and Design before founding the Red Dirt Studio in Mount Rainier. Her work is included in the collection of the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Museum of the City of New York, the U.S. Department of State, the Wilson Building downtown, and in many private collections. So Margaret, a couple things really strike me about your approach to artist support and community engagement, and especially around the sharing of resources and your efforts to get people to understand how to monetize their work. So you talk about the generosity of spirit among artists and how that's key. And I want you to talk more about that, and also how do artists obtain resources, not just for the product, but for the process?
That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, I know. That's like three in one for you.
So what we do at Regular, I mean, I think artists are naturally generous people, but I think what we have done sort of set up a structure that's about, I mean, being generous has so much to do with being generative and making things and putting them out into the world. So we do have a seminar. So there's about 13 artists in the studio right now, at different levels of professional, you know, ability and all that. So Saturday mornings is our one time a week for 3 hours. We meet, we do business of art, we critique, but really it's a time where you can go in and say, I need this, you know, I need some help with this, and you can say, what can I do for you? And so, you know, J.J. McCracken is one of our artists in residence. You know, J.J. can say, I've got this performance coming up, I'm trying to work this out. You know, we can offer some engineering ideas, we can offer some actual labor, let's build this thing. We can offer staffing, you know, people to help you make things, people to help you, you know, actually work on your project during the performance, you know, all this kind of stuff. Lindsay Rowinsky's here. She's a former Red Dirt member. You know, we helped her kind of in the early stages of your hugging project. You know, you're trying to work out how this was going to go. And so, you know, Saturday morning we go out. Everybody, you know, there's maybe 12 of us that went out and stood out on Rhode Island Avenue and helped you hug a building. You know, so it's like, you know, sometimes you just need... What if you have 12 or 13 sets of hands to put on your project for a few hours? That can move it forward in a way that you can't do by yourself. So there's so many ways that that happens. And there's such a diversity of artists there who bring, you know, Siobhan Rigg, who's professor of new media at GW. You know, she brings her whole, you know, different set of resources than I do, who's more like material and building based, than JJ, who's performance based. And you know, we have Monica Jahn-Bose has her, the residue of her performance in the back of the room here. She came to Red Dirt as a painter over here and an activist over here. And what she's been able to do through being around JJ and seeing JJ's work over the years, Monica has helped you on your projects. And she's learned a lot about what she wants to do in her work. And now she's doing some really phenomenal work where she's bringing these two sides together. And it's just really fun to sort of be part of that, help people move their ideas forward, challenge them critically, and help them with resources. I can't even remember what question.
Okay, I'll remind you. So sticking on the topic of generosity, though, yeah, for just a little bit longer. So you said that artists are naturally generous, which is true, but there's also a lot of fear and hoarding that goes on, and I want you to talk about how we can work against that and buy into this larger philosophy of there's enough for all.
Well, that is really philosophy of our studio too, you know. I think we are naturally generous, but also there's never enough, right? You're always trying to, there's not enough money, there's not enough time. But we really have this conscious philosophy in the studio. You bring a collector in, a client, a designer, whomever, show them around. You know, you introduce them to the other people, you show them other people's work. You know, I did an installation this past week, and I took my studio assistant, Ellie, and I was like, Ellie, you should bring your stuff from Crafty Bastards, because I think she's really going to like this. Ellie ended up selling her some work, too. And that's just, like, we do that, and I find that, like, when I bring a collector through the studio, they're is so much value added to them to share what else is going on. They're so excited to see everything. It's not just like, no, I want your money. I don't want you to see anybody else's work, because if you buy theirs, you might not buy mine. Instead of less is more, more is more. And really, like, we see that come back over and over again in the studio.
Okay, so the third question of the one question was around monetizing, and you talked about it a little bit, but when I talked to you the other day, you were sharing, you know, the challenges of, back to the multiple role issue, you know, so many of us teach or do something else, and the challenges of doing more than one thing, how do you get those things to feed off of each other? How do you pay for the creative process?
Well, I'm gonna look at JJ McCracken when I talk about this, and you're laughing. You know what I'm gonna say, right? We always talk about this thing, because yeah, you're teaching, you're trying to make your project, and there's never enough time. So, well, what if you bring your students and have them help you on the project, and so you're both teaching and moving your project forward? And can you? I think there's a tendency to feel like, well, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing, teaching. That's really my work. I should save that for later. But no, actually, what better thing can your students learn than getting to participate in this? And I say that's just one example, but it's another sort of conscious, if you think about, you know, selling something twice. Like, you can't, like, you can sell the object, and then can you also sell the making of the object? You know, it's an experience, and it's an opportunity. Can you bring people into that, and can that be an opportunity to, you know, it's not just about like I need to make money everything I do, but it's about doing double duty, like having space work for more than one thing, having your time work for more than one thing, and just what are the ways that you can double that up, and being very conscious about working that way.
Great. Thank you. So on to Ryan Frank. Ryan is an artist and curator based in Brooklyn now. His work has been exhibited at venues including Recession Art and the Invisible Dog Art Center. He was an artist in residence at the Wasaic Project and now oversees their art installation. He's also a collection director at the Granary, a private exhibition space located in Litchfield County, Connecticut. So Ryan, like the other panelists, your work is falling outside of traditional exhibition models, and you're doing this purposefully in order to reach a broader audience and broader support base. What are ways that you are bridging different communities, both across socioeconomic lines, disciplines, and also how are you bridging the gap, if you will, between emerging artists and established artists? How are you bringing those folks together?
All good questions, and hopefully I can answer some of that. So my background is in theater, and I think that a lot of my art practice and also my work as a curator is sort of rooted in that, and that theater is naturally collaborative, and that it involves a lot of different entities coming together for a shared goal, which I think is, you know, can be different than your work as an artist in the studio, or even as a curator, which is sometimes more develops more out of ideas and writing and research. So I started out curating with a collective called Ad Nauseam Lyceum, and we did a series of pop-up exhibitions around New York from about 2006 to 2009, and a lot of them were very informal, and you exhibited in spaces that were sort of non-traditional, empty storefronts that I got access to through an organization called Shoshama, which partners with real estate developers in the city that have empty space for a short period of time and then give it to artists for exhibitions, performances, and studios. Fast forward a few years ago, 2010, I became a resident at Wasaic Project, and Wasaic Project is an organization based in Wasaic, New York, which is this very small town that was the site of the very first Borden condensed milk factory. So it was a sort of thriving industrial hub in upstate New York, and like so many towns in upstate New York have become, you know, economically depressed over the last several decades. So Wasaic Project was started by three individuals who had access to this really beautiful grain elevator in Wasaic that was abandoned and was purchased by two individuals who wanted to save it just because they thought it was an important structure historically and didn't want to see it torn down. One of their daughters is an artist and decided to do an art show in there one summer, and that went well. They did it again, and then they got access to another building and decided to start a residency, and I was fortunate enough to be in their very first residency session. I think everything at Wasaic is sort of rooted in the fact that it is in this very small town, and I think over time, Wasaic Project has sort of played a role as of being a sort of meeting point for different economic and social groups within the larger community. Upstate New York and Western Connecticut, where I live, I think there's a great disparity economically between its residents, and there's sort of weekenders, people from New York who have second homes there, and I should clarify saying that Wasaic is about two hours north of New York City, and it's the very last stop of the Harlem Line Metro North train. So it's easy to get to and from the city, and so it makes it an attractive place for people to come up there for the summer, for weekends. And so in addition to that group, then there's you know, people who live there full time, most of whom were born and raised there, and a lot of people who, you know, lived their whole lives in Wasaic. And I think there's very little mix between those two entities. But Wasaic, being that it's an arts organization and it's in this small town, which is not a place where most of the weekenders have homes, but they have homes in other areas, has acted as a sort of meeting place, I think, between those two groups of people. I think that Wasaic has done a really good job at sort of, you know, catering to each of those groups and trying to find ways in their programming, education initiatives, et cetera, that sort of are attractive to a wide audience, which is pretty rare up there. So some of the things they've done is they've done fundraisers for the fire department, and one of those has been a cakewalk, which sounds like a very sort of simple, hokey thing, which it is, but it's actually been a great sort of cultural event, and because there's this group of artists there, they've contributed to what happens at the cakewalk, and a lot of times it's sort of, you know, there's both music and sort of extensions of people's art practices that go on at these things. The core of Wasaic Project has been their yearly festival, which is consists of an art exhibition, film programming, music, I think it's a way to sort of get the local community involved in something that they normally wouldn't. You know, I think so many organizations, nonprofits, can sort of exist in a bubble and exist for, you know, the more established art community, which I would say most of us are a part of here. It's great to sort of see Wasaic do programming that's been, consciously trying to engage with their community that they live in and their immediate neighbors. Some of the other things in addition to Wasaic, I've done curatorial projects. A recent one called Assembly Required, and it was an exhibition that took place in a sukkah during Sukkot. And this was a project that I did with a friend of mine, an artist named Danielle Dirschlag, and she approached me with this idea to do an exhibition in a sukkah, which is a sukkah is this temporary structure that Jews built during a harvest holiday, which just took place. And what we did is we decided to, we're first going to just do an exhibition in this structure on Danielle's apartment terrace, just hanging work in it. And then we decided to sort of make it into an art project with sort of collaborating with all 10 other artists. We built this structure together. And so the walls of this building were all made out of individual works by 10 different artists. So that was sort of using a religious model, religious ritual, as a way for an art exhibition to take place. So I think some of my interests and what I've done at Wasaic and my independent curating and in this recent project are sort of looking at ways that we can collaborate with communities that wouldn't normally be exposed to art or be interested in it, and also collaborations with religious ritual and thinking about, you know, ways that art can be presented just outside of, you know, a gallery exhibition. And I think that any time that you sort of step out and engage with a different group, whether it be social, cultural, and different artistic disciplines, it you know, leads to not just like meeting new people, but also just thinking about what art and exhibitions can be.
Aren't you also a pancake maker? Did you say something about pancakes?
Pancakes.
The pancake breakfast or something?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's in addition to the cakewalk, the Wasaic Project does regular pancake breakfast with the fire department. And it's all, you know, it's a small town. And so the fire department is all volunteer, and they need to raise money in order to protect the community. And so Wasaic Project has, you know, a lot of times, like during their festival, they did a pancake breakfast for the fire department and inviting all of these people who had come up to see art or live music, then, you know, go to the fire department and get breakfast and raise some money for them, which is great.
Great, beautiful, simple gestures and artists connecting to people where they live and each other. So I'm excited because we have time for some general questions that I wanted to ask the panel. And I want to start with James. James, what does artist utopia look like to you?
It's a loaded question. I'll maybe start from like backwards. It's interesting, the exhibition that Abigail curated that's currently at Transformer was part of a series at our space in St. Louis called How to Build a World That Doesn't Fall Apart. And which was interesting because it actually came from a quote that it was basically, what's interesting are worlds that do fall apart, and the artists are continually interested in those things that are not necessarily sustainable, but they are interesting. They are what changes the culture, they are what changes people. So I think about it a lot in terms of, you know, I don't know how much of utopias have a tendency to be a kind of final endpoint, a static thing that we're all working towards, and I think it's much more interesting to think about utopia as a process, utopia as experimentation. As an artist and a curator, as a writer, whatever kind of approach I take, I think I'm really interested in what are the things that allow people to freely experiment, to do the things that they want, to create meaning in what they're doing around them. And so I think utopia, in that sense, is that process. And the question is, how do we create an environment that supports that, which is maybe more of your question, you know, of what we want out of utopia. And I think what I want is artists able to control their space of exchange, to allow them to understand the terms in which they're addressing audiences. And I think that's the interesting ways that the arts in general have expanded, this sort of space of production, is that more and more I think artists are able to say, this is the path that I want to take, and I'll figure out ways to support that. And I think more people are figuring out that is interesting for everyone, if we can figure out ways to support those ways of working.
So does anyone else want to tackle this? So how do we create an environment that supports our utopia? And, or how do we deal with the challenge of access to space? It's a free-for-all. Or control over space.
I'll say something about that. I think so often we sort of see gentrification as being an enemy, which it certainly can be, and that there's few resources to go to as an artist. But I think, and I can only speak in my personal experience, in that with Shishama, with Wasaic Project, and now with Invisible Dog, where I'm an artist in residence. They're all organizations that have depended upon landlords who have given space to artists or arts organizations because they will take better care of it than a developer who wants to turn it into something else. That artists are caretakers for structures and buildings better than the free market can be. So I think that a healthy thing, is to look outside and think about how one can collaborate with people who have resources, and not just asking for money, but think about how, what we as artists are able to contribute to property and to sites that other people cannot.
Any challenges in controlling the terms? So James was saying, he wants a place of exchange, and also, but on our own terms, right? So if we're partnering, how do we control those terms? Can we?
I think so. Like, asking for things is a lot of times the hardest part, and that you can oftentimes be surprised by sort of proposing something and how someone who isn't an artist, doesn't come from that background, can sort of be enthusiastic about projects that allow for a certain type of collaboration to take place. I think, it has to be on your terms, but I think you also need a certain amount of flexibility in terms of how your work can take place and what types of projects that, not to change what you're doing, but to change how you do it.
Anyone else? Margaret, you kind of have a utopia going on, I think, Mount Rainier, and I want to move there tonight.
Come on, you can still buy a house.
So,
still affordable.
I'm curious about all of you are risk takers. So a lot of the projects that this initiative Link funded, there were major risks being taken in the 14 different cities and gambles, and we failed in D.C. to a certain extent. I'm not even going to go there. But I want to talk about risk taking and how you all are taking risks and sort of pushing the envelope to change the system. Do you feel that you're taking risks?
Well, this is sort of, sort of what we're talking about, sort of a tangent discussion, but I don't know. What I'm taking a risk with right now is I'm trying to buy a building. And so I'm taking a financial risk, and but I feel really strongly, we're talking about artists need to control their spaces, and I see the development happening in our area, which is great, but I also want to make sure that I don't get priced out of this area where I've been for 17 years and have helped to create. So, I'm jumping into this process of buying a building, which is huge and daunting. And there are resources, but I wish that there are more resources. It feels like a risk, but it also feels like I just need to find, I'm getting a good team of, I am fortunate that the guy who directs my gallery is an architect and he's helping. and the surveyor engineer that helped with Joe's Movement Emporium. You know, we have a great community, so people who have already gone down this path are kind of sharing, well, I had this guy, he helped me. You know, John Paradiso has been involved in, you know, opening the Gateway Art Center, and he's helping with all the resources. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like I'm the one taking the financial risk. And so what I, you know, my vision of Utopia is there are more resources for how to connect all that and pool that information. You know, so I do feel like I have company in it, but it's still scary.
Anyone else?
Well, I mean, just to tag on to what you said, I mean, there's a lot of financial risk within these projects. I mean, like, the reason that I was able to have my job where I work at Three Walls was because I fundraised for my job through the Community Supported Art Program. So, I mean, you know, so these things are tied together. It's not, you know, it's a risky business for nonprofit people all the time, but it's risky when you know are trying out these new initiatives and you have to try new strategies and you have to think like a different, you know, you have to sort of put on different hats when you're talking to different people. So I think it's sort of like just to underscore the reality of like a lot of, you know, the sort of risk that we're taking on when you have this really great community metaphor and you have a community behind you, but then you also sort of have a financial reality that you have to contend with as well. So, and you know, I think it's interesting, like the Transformer show that we have, and like, and to be in conversation with James and him and Bree are starting, you know, they're opening a new building, and you know, there's so much ambition in all of these projects, and that's totally, that's so exciting. But I think it's also important that we keep in conversation about, you know, how we're dealing with that stuff, because some of the artist subscription projects that are part of the Transformer show, they're no longer they didn't work as sort of financial, you know, projects, and so the artists had to move on. I know that sounds kind of depressing, but I also think it's just sort of like, if you're real about it, then you have to figure out, you know, how to rise to the occasion and try and figure out how to, you know, become, I guess, like one of the things that I struggle with or that I feel like is important is to not sort of stay within the network that I already know, but sort of try and figure out how to talk to people that are not already initiated in this kind of conversation, make the argument to them that they should be supporting artists. What does that mean? Oh, it means supporting experimentation. You don't know what you're going to get. I mean, those are really difficult conversations to have. But, you know, you just sort of are attempting to do it.
All right. So, thank you. I'm just really honored to be sitting here with you all. There is definitely a generational difference, having come up in the 80s and then, you know, hearing some of you who are younger and what you're doing. And there's a lot of hope at this table, and also just things are changing. Very exciting work that you're doing. I'm very excited to hear about the new NAO, the approach to, you know, the looking at this nationally, and hope to stay in touch with all of you. Please join me in thanking our panelists.